Do you mind if I get that?
Oh god, that was brilliant.
Welcome to Bigger Sheet Babes, episode number 16? 16, yes.
I have no idea.
It's number 16, it's number 16. A scandal in Belgravia. Belgravia, how do you say that, British person?
Don't know why you're not. Yeah, I'm dyslexic.
Okay, we might have an issue right here.
It's Belgravia.
Belgravia, there we go.
Belgravia.
Yay, we really liked it.
Well, maybe all of us.
We loved it.
Maybe Taylor doesn't. We don't know yet. We're going to find out. Kaffir Sekita.
Yay!
Taylor, Marie, and Turk. Merry old band.
Hello.
Hello.
Bonsoir.
We don't really have a coherent list of things to talk about. I think it's just a general kind of reaction of what we thought of the episode. So where's your list?
Okay.
I don't have a list.
We don't know that. They can't see us.
Hey, it's okay. Turk has a list.
Turk has a list.
We'll start with Turk's list. I like Turk's list.
Okay. It just says Jim, but it says Jim, and it says Staying Alive, and then I've drawn a picture of Jim on the phone next to the pool. That's my list.
Okay. I can see you have priorities. It's fine.
I just like that we've had a year and a half to think of what the resolution of this is going to be, and it ends up a phone call interrupts them, and he just walks off.
Just especially the looks on their faces, they were like, what's happening? What's going on?
I don't think anyone expected it like this. Everybody was speculating and having so many versions how it would be resolved, and I think everybody was duped.
Yes.
Moffat.
Moffat. I think that's what he was probably the most time thinking about.
The funniest thing about this was how, you know, I'm the only one on the podcast right now who had seen the episode before everyone else, and you could see people just wondering with the trailers in the last week about what was going to happen, and it was just hysterical, but at the same time it was excruciating because we couldn't talk about it, and we knew it was like a 2 minutes resolution, and it was just ridiculous. It was like, guys, you have no idea, it's like completely not what you're gonna see, expect anything, and we're just looking like very calm in the corner, like, I can't talk about it. So yeah,
I'm very impressed how long you lasted.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm very impressed by how long you contained that within yourself, like not talking about the episode.
I think it was probably on Tumblr or something, that their prediction was that it ended with a mariachi band coming in, and I think that was very close.
That's actually the best guess, which is
that's the best guess I've heard.
Yeah.
Nice one.
Oh, that could have been cool, though. Can you imagine?
And what a fantastic introduction to the character of that episode, which, of course, was the wonderful Irene Adler and her lovely bum.
Her lovely bum.
Well, her fingernails first, and then her bum.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, true. And then.
Yeah. And immediately... Just yeah, it's actually a brilliant exposition scene because you have everything in it with the highness. The lesbian factor that is talked about later in the episode as well, but it's not clear at the beginning. There's a lot of things in like 30 seconds. It's absolutely brilliant. And then the new credits.
Yes.
That looks amazing.
Credits.
Yep.
Yes. Yes, that looks absolutely amazing. Oh, God.
One second. I enjoy how he was very casually saying he was going to turn a person into shoes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I will skin you.
Like, I watched it again today, and so I'm trying to think about like how it went in order. So we saw Irene's bum, which is fabulous, and her garters. Oh. Credits. And Yes.
Say, if you're going in order, then we're heading into the beautiful montage of cases.
Oh, yes.
And logs that happens.
That was a wonderful amazing to get as many canon references in as they could squeeze into that episode.
Perfect.
Mm-mm. And also, that's I'm going to start now. I can start now, but I think we're going to talk about it along the whole episode, at how amazing Paul McGuigan work on the direction, editing, like,
oh,
choices.
Oh my god!
It's amazing. Like, the way it's edited, I mean, obviously there is some editing job as well, but the direction of the whole thing is brilliant. And it starts right from the start as well, so it's brilliant.
It's fantastic. Like, yeah. you're reminded of, like, of techniques he uses from the first series, like looking through windows and having doors open. I just think it's fantastic, like the way he uses framing. Like, framing is something you usually only think about in art, but like to use it in direction is a really interesting technique that he does.
Yeah.
I could talk about that for a long time.
Yeah, no, because Sherlock just looks different from every other show
it does,
on television. Yeah. It just has this different look, and I think he really expanded on that even more. Like, we'll probably talk about it later.
Yeah.
The text was different, but also, like not the dream sequences, or, like, the deduction sequences when Sherlock's, like, actually, like, by the car and stuff. I'm like, that's so good. And all the colors.
I'm quite fond of the transitions.
Yeah.
From thing to thing. Like, the spinning camera and stuff. It's very
Michel Gondry kind of trick, you know. It's all this, like, later on in the episode, the bed that comes up behind Sherlock actually came up behind Sherlock for real. Like, it's not a special effect, I think. I read it somewhere. I think Gatiss was talking about it at the Q&A, that they actually did that, really. So it works so well because it's really, really well thought. So, yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah. We're just sort of sat here like, ah.
Yeah.
And that's another reference right there.
There's a lot of awkward silence while everyone remember about the episode, and it's like, oh, yes.
And we're all just sat here fantasizing about it.
I've only gotten to see it three times now, okay?
And then we can talk about the whole transition to Buckingham Palace. And so first, the investigation through webcams, which is kind of a new thing. That was amazing. And then the whole bickering.
Yeah. I never go out unless it's at 7.
Yeah. I love that John, like, just goes with it. He's like, long suffering, but he still does it.
I have a mute button and I will use it.
Oh, that was golden.
Yeah, that was brilliant.
Now, the Buckingham Palace, favorite bit of that is when they just start giggling, and I can't tell if it's Sherlock and John or if it's Martin and Benedict.
Yeah.
Laughing.
They just, like, lose it in the middle of the scene, and they just kept it in.
Also, the ashtray killed me.
Yeah, the ashtray thing was brilliant.
My favorite line from that is, like, are we here to see the Queen? And then Mycroft walks in. He's like,
oh, yes.
Oh, I'd quite like about the deduction as well, like when he's in the flat and the guys appear, and I think this happens a lot in the episode, the audience is given an opportunity to make the conclusion for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Like when he looks at the man and sort of sees office job, you know, manicured, and then he's like, one dog, small dog, two, three, and then when it goes to Buckingham Palace, it like clicks. It's very well done. They do that a lot, like, and you are left to draw your own conclusions about what he is intending with the deductions, which we'll come to again, I guess, when we start talking more about Irene.
Yeah.
But yes, the Queen was funny.
And you got to see, like, more. The Holmes brothers dynamic that does encompass this entire episode. You got to see more of their backstory, more of their relationship, even if it's not always pleasant, but it. I
it was
love
a lot of my
in general.
I love the morgue scene.
Yeah,
the scene in the morgue. I mean, we can talk about it later, but that's for me. That's probably one of the most amazing thing in terms of backstory with so very little that is done about Sherlock and Mycroft. It's stunning, and the way it's shot as well is ridiculously beautiful. So yeah, that's yes. Thank you, Paul. If you hear that, I don't know, but just thank you, okay? Just thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Brilliant.
Thank you.
I'm still thinking about Mycroft going, "I'll be mother."
I know.
Yes.
The whole side of him in a nutshell.
You know, I missed that first time round because everybody was still laughing about the Queen comment.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's like the whole episode is quotable to the death, so this is going to happen a lot, I think.
Yes, people will be quoting it quite a lot, I feel. We're driving people insane who haven't seen it yet, and they're like, what?
Yeah, so we went Buckingham Palace, so now we switched to going to Irene's place.
Oh, and can just say, we did notice that certain somebody has buffed up a little bit since season one. We wonder why.
I don't know, crawling on a stage at the National Theatre does that to a human being, I guess. So.
Well, maybe we should all start doing that.
Well, that would be awful.
Yeah.
We're allowed to oogle. This is a salacious podcast. I already put a warning.
Oh, yes.
I'll do it, like, recorded, like, the beginning.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yes. I don't care what the fans say. If I want to talk about going into boys' dormitories at night, I will do. There are no apologies. I just had to get that in there.
Sorry, Paul. Okay, so anyways, so going to Irene's, the punching scene...
Oh, God.
Punch me in the face. I always hear punch me in the face, but usually it's subtext.
I also liked that we were shown how Irene does her makeup and does her lips red, and Sherlock says he needs to add some color to his face, blood red. It's I thought it was an amazing little detail.
Like, they're always, like, balancing the two, going back and forth, and I think that was really neat, because they did it multiple times, like, with the pictures and then with, like, putting on disguises.
There was a lot of bouncing around between them, and the parallels of the, I guess you could call it, the scene of putting on the war paint.
Yeah.
It was the, exactly. Preparation for going into battle.
Yeah, and then a lovely nod to the canon with the priest outfit and being... injured. It's so good.
Can I just have a John Watson moment when he says that he was an army doctor and he said he killed a man and I had bad day. I was just like, that is brilliant. It's like, it's again so much story about John Watson as well, which I think it was a really nice touch as well. So yeah, it was really cool.
And then whatever accent Sherlock was doing for the priest, it's like the angle of his face and everything. Like, I could not stop laughing. Like, you saw me, I was just like giggling to myself. But
no, it was fantastic. The little kind of ooh. It was absolutely hilarious.
And then it's great because then we get into the first face-off between Sherlock and Irene, and the moment she walks in, it like completely disarms him. And she's like, aha!
Got you there.
Yeah. No, that's just brilliant because it's so unexpected. Well, unless you've seen the adverts. but it's fantastic because she's suddenly broken a massive social taboo by appearing in front of him like that. And it's so totally unexpected that it, like, throws his brain off. And, of course, very smart, because then we see on the screen, ...
It's so good!
Because he can't read anything off of her, which is brilliant.
And that's what she intended. And then he goes to John, and he can tell all these things, and he looks back to her, and you can just see, like, his eyes working. Like, he can't understand. It's like, I can't.
Brain does not compute,
It's great.
Because he is so used to being filled with information that to not have it presented to him is very annoying, I imagine. Very frustrating.
See, the part of my I'm way too concerned with minor characters, might I add, that in his deductions about John, I was utterly thrilled that he's reading A Night Out with Stamford on John's face.
Yeah.
Because I love Mike Stamford, and I think he should always be there. Anyway, continue. Go back to our...
No, that's a nice touch, actually, that there are characters in the background that are still acknowledged. It kind of beefs out the world a lot, like that there are characters that the audience can be like, I remember him. Oh yes, and then the Americans
we're a nap
because then he sends out John, who then
another canon reference
sets fire to papers.
It was brilliantly done, and also that because the safe was behind the mirror. By the fireplace, it's totally
same thing, it's great.
Yeah.
And I do love the whole play about you know, like John Watson womanizer during the whole episode as well. It's like, seriously, there's so many little things with all so many characters, and I'm like,
I just love watching Martin Freeman's face, like in every episode. Whenever he's in the scene, I like to watch his face because he is so good at using facial expressions to express so much, like how he's straining to keep his eyes on her face. It's just brilliant.
That was so painful for him.
Yeah, I know. And it was just, you could just see it. Like, I think that's one of the things that was really beautiful about this episode, is there was a lot of that going on. Like, all of the actors are fantastic at that. No words, just a look. And people, you know, you were either rolling around laughing or kind of had that, moment, or, you know, in tears, because they're just so fantastic.
It's all very subtle, but it's beautiful. It's like, it's a testament to how good these people are at their jobs.
They've definitely upped the game.
Yes.
Also, kudos to Paul again for his brilliant direction.
Yes. To include all of those details.
This podcast is a love letter to Paul McGuigan.
Oh, Paul.
Need Paul's t-shirts.
I think we do. We've become a bit of the Paul McGuigan Appreciation Society, haven't we?
Okay, so back on topic. So they're doing the Sherlock's found the safe, and then the Americans come in, brandishing our guns as we always do. That's what we do.
Using our gruff accent as we always do.
Yes.
There
are definitely no stereotypes in Sherlock.
No stereotypes. But what I love, another testament, like, just to the character development, like, Sherlock is completely calm about it until they threaten to shoot John. And then he's like, okay!
Yes. Oh my god, not again! God damn.
And then there's, like, this, and then there's obviously the connection between Sherlock and Irene. It's like, okay, you've told me it. I don't know it. Wait, yes, I do. And then it goes. And then they have the reference to a previous case and that amazing slow-mo action scene, which is just great. Really nice.
It was a good touch, actually, the slow motion. It does sort of ring a little bit of the Guy Ritchie Sherlock Holmes. I don't know if that was intended or not, actually, whether they just chose to use it to show, because obviously slow motion is used in that way to show what's happening so that you can register everything that's going on. My mum loves that because she's like, I can see everything that's happening. really makes her very happy, so thank you for that, Paul McGuigan.
it's either the slow motion or the Bourne shoulder camera effect, and I have to say I prefer the slow motion as well, because you can actually see what's going on. It's true. Yes. So yeah, it's quite nice.
It's done really effectively. It's
yeah.
It's really good.
It has a nice vibe. And also, Irene was such a badass in that scene. Like, when she grabbed the gun, you're like, okay, she's done this.
It was good.
It's like, do you mind? Not at all. Bam. And then, of course, he has the phone, and the game is on in a very Cumber Creature way.
Yeah. Well, there is a lot of creative batch during the whole thing. Oops, I said the word. There is a lot of creative batch in the episode. I saw it.
Yes, now I
didn't saw it.
For anyone who out there who has seen Frankenstein, and for all those of you who didn't, sorry, no, I'm not sorry. there is a like you can. That's actually the only moment I think in the whole of the episode in the whole of Sherlock that I have ever broken, like, I've ever seen him break character, like, in my eyes. Like, whenever I see him on screen, like, he is Sherlock, like, 100%.
Completely unrecognizable.
You would not, you know, think that Benedict Cumberbatch and Sherlock is the same person, but, like, that was that one moment when he was kind of rolling around and drug addict, and I was like, oh, there's the creature. And that was the only moment.
I agree.
Broke for me, but if you've never seen it, doesn't matter. It's fine.
Yeah, it was even more obvious when he wakes up in the bed. That was like the final thing. It was like, It was really funny.
The woman.
Yeah.
Then we get to see.
Sorry, Benedict.
Yeah. The deduction of the case was really brilliant as well. Like the bit, obviously, when he's explaining the case through Irene. It's quite interesting actually, because it kind of gives you an idea of like how his brain works, which actually is interesting because obviously he guessed Irene's measurements just by looking at her, which tells me that he probably has the ability to see things in that way, like a three-dimensional analytical brain. So to see, like, kind of, I guess, like a personification of the way that he sees things, mm-hmm. like in that weird little dream sequence, was really fascinating.
And that just sequence in general is just beautiful. Like the music, Be Still My Heart, so very pretty.
it was just
so damn pretty. That scene is so damn pretty.
And we've already talked about the bed. I know.
And then the bed, yeah. So then we get to finally see more Baker Street. We get to see a lot more Baker Street this time around.
Yes, actually Mrs. Hudson's rooms.
Mm-hmm.
I did like the periodic table.
Yeah. The judo certificate on the wall.
The judo certificate.
Yeah.
People on Where Sherlock found that, and they were like, this is what it is, and it's like his the top judo certificate. So another callback to the canon. They're so good at that.
Yeah.
There is a picture of Edgar Allan Poe as well in his room, I think. Someone mentioned that.
Really?
Yeah.
I noticed that.
Yeah.
Eagle eyes, people, eagle eyes.
There's a weird like a lamp thing, but I think that's just a weird lamp.
I was also going to make a note of how tidy Sherlock's bedroom is compared to the rest of the flat. He obviously keeps his crap elsewhere.
And there is another thing that Mark Gatiss mentioned at the Q&A after the show, but apparently you can't really see it in the episode. There is a picture of Sherlock and Mycroft as kids, and Mycroft is obese. So it's apparently in Sherlock's room, but it can't be seen on camera, which I found extremely sad. Yes. So yeah, he mentioned that. It's somewhere, but it's just a private book, I guess. Yeah, hopefully. Yeah, that'd be nice.
So assumably it doesn't appear in any other episode.
Well, maybe. Who knows?
Maybe.
Now we can look for it.
Now we know of its existence, yes.
Okay.
So
Irene comes back, she drops off the coat.
Which was brilliant. And then, of course, we get...
Which has become, like, everyone's text alert. As well as the Bee Gees being everyone's ringtone now. Just, like, spread like fire.
Yeah, no, that was great.
Yeah, I've had calls from so-called friends who then just hang up. They don't really want to speak to me. They just want me to have staying alive while I'm in a shop.
That's the only reason to have that ringtone, really, is to be abused by your friends.
I was thinking of changing my text message one to say it again from when he screams down the phone.
It'd be terrifying.
Say it again.
So that,
well,
that
everyone
we
else is having
switch.
The Sherlock sex noise.
That's true. So now we can switch about something that I absolutely adore in this episode, which is the fantastic dynamics inside 221B between Sherlock, John Watson, and Mrs. Hudson, and the fact that they had like one big happy family living all together, and there is this amazing scene with Mycroft when, you know, they're talking and there is, shut up, Mrs. Hudson, and everyone is like, what?
That is brilliant. I think this whole episode again was a kind of a Mrs. Hudson appreciation episode. Yeah. Like how much Miss Wheeler will love Mrs. Hudson.
She's amazing. She's such a badass.
Yeah, no.
The way she took out that phone from her bra. It killed me.
Yeah, no, she's brilliant. She's great.
What is it again? Mrs. Hudson living 221B, England would fall. That's brilliant.
Oh, it's great. I think there's just something about Mrs. Hudson that's obviously like, you know, she can't be that delicate because of the things that she deals with, like in the flat. Mm-hmm. And then she sort of portrays this very like genteel woman, but then something happens and you think there's more to you, Mrs. Hudson, than meets the eye.
You mean like a man gets thrown out of the window in her building and her concern is her bins?
She's either very cool or very batty.
I think it's a bit of both.
Yeah, she's have to be a bit eccentric to live in Sherlock.
Yeah, and we can mention something that we haven't mentioned yet, and yet he had some really good scene at the beginning, which is with Lestrade. It's criminally underused in the episodes that I have to say, but he had some really cool moments, especially at the beginning where he said, "You're gonna see Sherlock, try not to punch him in the face," and also the moments where he finds the guy who was thrown by the window, and he say, "How many times did he fall by the window?" Which is quite like he's completely aware of what's going on, but he's kind of my favorite moment,
and I think we can skip to Christmas now, is when Molly her dress and his eyes turn to like the size of the moon.
That is a wonderful Rupert Graves moment. And that was pure Rupert Graves. Just like, whoa.
I think was it Lou Brealey who tweeted earlier today that she had to talk to Rupert Graves about outstaging her with his antics in the background of the shot, which I think is really true, because everyone was like, look at Lestrade over there. It was brilliant. It was amazing.
Oh my god! But
yeah.
Poor old man.
Can we just talk about John's sweater as well, please? Because this is just, you know,
this was brilliant.
He's like, where did you find it? Where can I find it? And where can I wear it every day? Because it's amazing.
Well, she already mapped it out. She's starting on it. She said by the
time
she'll have something.
She is a champion knitter. She is a knitter of champion proportions.
My sweater will be up there.
Yep.
It's happening.
Actually, it's for me.
Is it for you?
It is for me. She took my measurement and she's apparently trying it. I can't wait.
I think we need to talk. Yeah. The Christmas scene is another indication of just like how living with John Watson has humanized Sherlock a great deal.
Immensely, yeah.
Like he actually becomes sympathetic, and you can see like the shock on John's face.
Well, I kind of get the impression that he's probably never had a Christmas party before, like because of John and Mrs. Hudson. Mm-hmm. It's not just John; it's like almost he's now has like a sphere of emotional support.
He has a little family.
It is. It's like a sphere of emotional support that he never thought he needed, but he kind of now has, like against his consent, and he.
Like,
has to live with them, but he also likes living with them. That's the thing.
And also, the whole Molly scene was heartbreaking.
I was shouting.
Oh god.
Oh, poor Molly.
It's like, please stop, Sherlock. Don't do it. Please stop.
Or just put me out of my misery already.
No.
But then he apologizes, and it's good. But then
I quite like how she stood up for herself as well. She was like, "You're always so mean," and it's like he actually needs somebody to say that, not just someone who is emotionally vulnerable like her, and actually make him realize what it is that he does.
I really love it that on one hand Sherlock is so observant, and on the other hand he's so oblivious to some things.
Yeah.
It's just baffling.
Well, that's what he is, isn't he? It's not that he's oblivious, it's he doesn't care.
Socially inappropriate.
She's like that. She's like, I just don't care.
Yeah, everything else is transport.
Yep.
And then it's the phone in the gift, and then it's going to the morgue with Mycroft. Oh, there is the phone call to Mycroft, who is all alone for Christmas, which is heartbreaking as well. I don't know if everyone felt the same, but I was like, oh my god, Mycroft is alone.
I think
he doesn't want to do the Christmas phone calls. I like that. We're not going to have a Christmas phone call now, are we? Like,
yeah. Yeah, so he's like almost annoyed that Sherlock's calling him for Christmas. So he's still in his suit, so it kind of makes me think that
he was at work.
Yeah, Mycroft, he's just always working, like it doesn't matter.
Maybe that was the one moment where he could just sit down and be like,
please.
Yeah. Just a moment where he, like, maybe, like, a moment where he can just switch off his brain and stare at the fire.
And then Sherlock calls.
And he was like, oh my god.
It's the annoying little
misery.
And then it gets really...
Yeah, and...
Yep.
sorry. And then the morgue, which is probably one of my favorite scenes of the whole episode as well, because it brings so much light on Sherlock and Mycroft and how, you know, they're quite bickering at it, you know, with each other all the time, but they know they're very similar and they're very, like, they're on the same boat, completely separated from the rest of the world. And this beautiful, beautiful scene in the hallway where Mycroft offers a cigarette to Sherlock and then to just talk about being different is so stunning. It's amazing. It's beautiful. Yeah. Sorry, I got emotional here.
No, it's a very telling scene. And the mm-hmm. fact that Sherlock accepts a cigarette, and now they've sort of had like this sort of like phone tree of like, when Sherlock, did they feel like he's going to go to the drugs and stuff, so then...
That was so brilliant.
It was so good.
And how subtle it was. Mm-hmm. So you could sort of... They never said what it was they were doing, but you just knew.
You just knew. And, like, so John asked, like, did you take the cigarette? He's like, yes. He's like, shit. It's like, we've checked everything. Like, John and Hudson have been through everything. So even when... what is it... It's like, are you sure this is like a danger night?
Yeah, and he's like, I never know.
I'm like ripping my heart out. It's like, because they just all care about him so much and they want to protect him.
They even have that, the code speaking danger night and so on. It indicates that there have been danger nights previously and John is aware about that. And it's like, well, it's so realistic dealing with addicts of any kind, and it was brilliant.
It was very, very tastefully done.
Yeah, it was.
And and also Mrs. Hudson is like still part of that dynamic as well, which she's one of my favorite in the episode. It's like she's always there. They know it's like a big entity of people like gravitating around Sherlock, and it's so beautifully done all during the whole time of the episode. It's beautiful.
Yeah, no, the way that they've charged up the dynamic in this is fantastic. And what I was having a think about this earlier, because obviously the next sequence that we move into after that is Sherlock apparently going into mourning for Irene. Now I was thinking about this because he blatantly knows that she's still alive. Like, he obviously, you know, said, you know, that's her, and like knew that it was, like, it wasn't, because he like seen her, unless it was a very good double.
Do you think so?
I think he knew.
I don't think so. He's literally in shock when he leaves the warehouse.
You see, the thing is, I don't think he was in mourning because he thought Irene was dead. I think, this is just my personal opinion, that he was in mourning because he couldn't see her again and he'd lost his playmate. I think that's how he sees Irene. Now, obviously, if I watch the episode again, I could, you know, be proven to be wrong. I think, actually, no, genuinely, he does think he's dead. But there is something in the way that he acts like, it almost like a, he always acts a bit like a petulant child anyway. But there was somebody who was interesting, but in a different way to the way Moriarty is. And that's when Sherlock kind of loses his ability to be moral, because he's like, ooh, let's play. You know, this is fun. This is different. You know, this is something that, like, stimulates my mind in the way that it was intended for. You know, it's that kind of idea that she's there and she's interesting, and then she goes away and he's like, well, fine.
I don't know if I necessarily agree with you, but I think that does have a big part to do with it, like with the mourning and stuff. I do think that she's dead.
Yeah.
But I think that, like, having that mind that he could connect to, I think that is part of, like, his big mourning, because I don't think he would have...
I like my playmate theory.
No,
she's
it's
a play.
Fine.
She's
it's
his.
Fine.
Like, let's play, but in a kind of morbid way.
I don't think John would have been so adamant for her to tell him that she was alive if he didn't think that he was in proper, like,
mourning.
Yeah.
And John was really angry at Irene.
Like, it's a really passionate scene, like, very well done by Martin Freeman.
Yes.
This is my absolute favorite scene of the whole episode. The warehouse scene sums up everything from character development on Irene to defining the relationship between the characters and how they care for Sherlock in different ways, and how, you know, again, gravitating around Sherlock, another character kind of comes in the equation, which is she's Irene, and also backstories on the characters, and also it's everything in so little. And again, Martin Freeman is so absolutely brilliant. Everything is on his face. He doesn't even have to say words sometimes. It just shows on his face. Mm. And just give him another BAFTA, for fuck's sake.
He'll probably get it.
Sorry. I had to swear because this is me, the French, and I had to swear this once in the podcast.
It's normally me, actually. But...
Oh, really? Oh, good.
Fuck, shit, cunt, pussy. It doesn't matter.
Well, I never...
That was a bit rude.
That sounds. That's what somebody who was watching the episode with us was very upset about, the scene with Sherlock deducing Molly. He was like, well, that was just rude.
You know, but the warehouse scene is great because it does sort of define, like, the relationships, but in the end, like, it doesn't matter. So John says, like, you know what, I'm not gay. And Irene's like, I am, but... It's like, it doesn't actually matter because we both care about Sherlock. Like, we both love him in our own ways. And it doesn't matter, like, sexual orientation, our relationship to him. Like, it's completely out the window. And I think that was very well done and by both actors, very well written by Moffat. It sort of, like, summed everything up very tightly.
I love how they play with that, actually, in this. It's very... Because it's not just... They could have just done a purely superficial... modern update, but in fact they've done more than that because they've added kind of modern dynamics, and the way that modern people think is obviously different to the way that Victorian people think, because if you made an assumption like, oh, there must be a couple, they'd be thrown in prison in Victorian times. So you didn't make that kind of assumption about people. But nowadays, like, there's more freedom for people, especially in England, I might like to add, for thinking, you know, there's more to a relationship than what we assume on the surface. And I think that's really interesting that they do play with that. And it's not just given as a straightforward, you know, this is how things are. It's actually more complicated than that.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Mm. But it's thank you, Stephen Moffat.
Brilliant, brilliant.
And then, of course, Irene finds out she's live. He goes into this weird, hazy thing. And then there's, like, the really, like, sort of heart-wrenching scene where everyone thinks that, like, something's happened to Mrs. Hudson. And like, you had told me before, like, things had happened, but, like, I was still like, oh, my God! How could you do that to her?
That was a fantastic example of also using the deductions for us to make our own assumptions about what Sherlock was about to do to that man. That was fantastic.
Well, for a brief moment when he's actually looking, he's like sizing up, like seeing like where he's actually going to hurt him, like whatever. Yes. There's that sort of moment that it can flicker between Sherlock and Moriarty, at least that I thought. He could like keep across that line, and he kind of does, not as badly as he could have.
Yeah.
But there's sort of that, like the way he just looks at this guy, and you're like, you could so easily be so very evil.
Yeah, no,
And he does throw the man by the window, so...
What was it they say in Firefly? It's like, I'm not a good man, I'm just an okay man, or just a man.
And then they have mince pies downstairs.
Yeah, Sherlock eats a mince pie. What's
he
up with that?
He eats.
I bet he's a massive sugar fiend, you know. It's one of those, because obviously, like, he doesn't eat much. I bet he, like, stuffs sweets down his gob, like, it's going out of fashion, because that'll probably be what keeps him going.
Yeah.
Yeah, when he says, I don't eat, I bet he's scoffing sweets. I bet he is. I know.
But he's doing it. He's eating because he's in Mrs. Hudson's flat. You know, he has like he goes to another place and then he starts eating, which I found really funny, in a way, like conflicting.
It's not
the eating in his own place.
It just shows like how close the relationship is. Because I know, like, if you go to like a really good friend's house or something, you can open their fridge and grab food out of it.
Yeah.
That's what
It could just be that he's really entitled, but. But yeah, no, I concede your point.
And now I can only see Mrs. Hudson as some kind of ex-spy living quietly in a little flat in the same address, but she has like a history and
who
everything.
Who knows what Mrs. Hudson's been up to.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
She's married to a man who was sentenced to death, and Sherlock made sure of it, so there's always more to her.
Indeed.
Yep.
Okay. And then, okay, let's think. That's next.
And is it Irene just showing up in his bed?
Yes.
On the run?
Yes, she's on the run. She shows up and she wants her phone back. And he isn't giving it.
Nope.
There is this whole absolutely brilliant exchange between Irene and Sherlock where they're just kind of... I'm going to make that the peacock analogy again, but that's basically what it's all about. It's like these two, you know, they just turn around each other, look at each other, try to estimate how they're going to approach each other as well. And John is just sitting there thinking, what the hell is going on right there? And it's amazing. It's so funny. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
Hamish.
Yes, John Hamish. What's his
name? Yes, Hamish. Thank you.
James. Brilliant, brilliant.
I was just imagining one of these little totally tartan-clad kids when he said that. I was like, Irene and Sherlock should have a Scottish baby called Hamish. And then I was like, what? It's like every time something comes up, my brain thinks this really weird mental image. I will be expecting fan art of this as a present for my wonderful idea, if anyone would like to draw it.
The child conceived by their eyes in that moment.
One of my ideas is like, I would have you on this table and make you beg for mercy twice. And then, like, I've never begged for mercy in my life. Twice.
It's just brilliant. I think that Stephen Moffat writes her kind of female character very, very well, because you believe that she would do it. And I really like her, like, for that. And I think in that moment he kind of believes it as well. Yeah. He's kind of like, oh, maybe.
Seduction.
Brainy is the new...
And again...
Brainy is sexy, yes, and 100 times yes for that.
Yeah.
Like,
can we take a minute to talk about Lara Pulver in that episode? Because seriously, she managed to come into a show that has such strong acting already and such strong characters, and she's like the woman. She comes into the show and she gives us Irene Adler, and she's absolutely amazing. She brings everything, and she's so much of an equal to Sherlock as well, which makes it absolutely brilliant. So. Thank you, Lara, again. I keep thanking people randomly, so can we all just give BAFTA to everyone just on my behalf?
Yeah.
BAFTA's for everybody!
For
BAFTA's
all of the people!
BAFTA's for everybody! Win all the BAFTAs!
Oh, we said the same thing, yes!
All the BAFTAs!
Yeah, no, definitely full points to Lara Pulver. She was phenomenal. And that is, it takes, I think, probably a lot of confidence to come in into such a strong, already a show that's so strong, and be a character that defines the entire episode. Even to the point where she, obviously it revealed at the end that Moriarty's working for her.
Mm. Yeah, and this is something that I want to make very clear, because there have been a lot of blog posts about saying, oh, she had to work for Moriarty, so she's such a weak woman. It's like, no, bullshit. She consulted Moriarty. He is working for her.
Bullshit.
Bullshit. He is working for her. Watch the damn episode again.
Yep. Exactly. His title is consulting criminal, which means he's a consultant.
Yes.
She hired him.
Yes.
He was helping her. And she even says, like, he didn't ask her anything, so he didn't ask for payment. He just likes to create trouble. And he's like, my kind of guy. And she had no idea of their previous whatevers. So it's like, because I was just so angry, because I read this blog today, and it just pissed me off so much, saying, oh, she had to go to him, so obviously she's such a weak woman. I'm like, no, he's working for her. Did you not watch the episode? Watch it
again.
Well,
she's obviously a pretty strong businesswoman, considering the amount of connections that she has. And to have that phone for her own protection, because she'd gotten so high up in, you know, the chain of things, because she was such a good dominatrix, apparently.
Yes.
There you go. I didn't know that was a career that you could see succeed very well in, but apparently you can.
Yeah, like professional.
Oh, yes, you can.
All girl, in a way.
Yep.
But also, for me, it's like, the way I see it as well, it's like, I mean, I can go on forever, especially when we go toward the end and the infamous final scene where everyone is talking about on the internet, having different opinions about it. But my opinion from A to Z in the episode is that Irene is completely in control in everything she does, and even more so, the fact that she hired Moriarty as a consulting criminal on what she does shows that she has the luxury that to not bother about the little details that Moriarty is going to take care of. She's so high up, she's so like in that place where she has so much control and power, and it's amazing, it's brilliant, because that's for me, that's a very strong female character, and you know, I embrace it, I love it, and thank you, that was brilliant.
And so, again, yeah. The one thing that sets her apart from Sherlock, actually, is that when she has everything is taken away from her, when the mobile phone is given up, because she has no support group, whereas Sherlock has a massive support group now of people who can help him if things go wrong, but she has nobody.
She has no one.
Because she's isolated herself, and that's the difference in her character, even though she, you know, she has feelings and things, she purposefully isolates herself for her own protection. And that is, again, where they're different, whereas he seems to have gathered all these people, like, without trying. Whereas she, obviously, I think she's the kind of person, this is just me extrapolating, that deliberately pushes people away, because maybe she knows that she gets attached to people, and maybe that's why she isolates herself.
Maybe, yeah.
Possibly.
That's possible, yeah.
It's also, I think, being related to that dominatrix thing going, because, well, it's a power play, and I think she got used to that, and
yeah,
it seeps in her life too, not only her job but her life, being in control always and forever.
Yeah, so she, to be in control, she must, you know, be that way, be isolated herself.
Feelings make people do irrational things, and being in control, that's
and in the end, that's what sort of where she fucks up. Not to put too point of point on it, but
not to be too dead.
Because she fucks up with the whole Sherlock thing, so he gets the thing, and then she's left with nothing, and she's like, well, shit, you know, I'm gonna die. She's like, you're right, I'm not gonna last 6 months. Because she's completely in control into that moment. Like, she makes Mycroft, like, sink in his chair, like, well, shit. So she's...
Yeah, can we just say, she beat both of them.
She beat both of them.
She took down both the Holmes brothers. I mean, shit.
Shit,
that was just badass. I'm sorry,
girl.
It's just, I disagree. I hate the ending. I think that she loses, and it upsets me.
How do you
think am on the
loses? I'm genuinely curious about this.
Because she lost everything. You just said it.
Because she lost everything.
Well, I have an in-between opinion about that, which is that when people keep saying she loses everything, I still think, basically, the way I see it is that until after the plane scene, where she, this is like the kind of canon-related story, where she basically pawns everyone and say, well, I win. And then there is there is the phone thing happening, but everyone is like, from that point, she loses everything. I can't really agree with that for one reason, is that she might be losing, like, the phone and everything, but what she did is that she won on one level. She made Sherlock care enough, which leads to the final thing, which is why people are so talking about it and it's so controversial. But at the end, people are always saying, oh my God, she's like, she's a woman, she's a damsel in distress, and she needs to be rescued by Sherlock. I'm sorry, but Sherlock would not go and rescue anyone else except for maybe John or Mycroft or Mrs. Hudson. And where she wins really hard in this episode is that she made him care enough so that he would know what she was doing at that time, and he would know that she would need maybe a bit of a hand for this. And I could totally see, you know, like this kind of twisted relation created between them, where they would be back and forth saving each other's ass on a regular basis just because they're so similar. There is no gender issue in this. It's about two people who found themselves in the same isolated place where they're completely similar, and they just know they're going to be there for each other in some kind of strange way. So that's the way I see it. Like, she doesn't lose completely in the way I see it. That's how I see it.
Yeah, I wish Artie was here. She says it much better than I do. I completely agreed with her. Did you
points on it.
We got into a big debate last night.
Yeah, there was some shouting.
The thing is, I do not see Irene at the end being weak, because she did not ask Sherlock to rescue her. She was completely prepared to die. Wherever she ended up, whatever she did, she took accountability for her actions.
Yes.
She said goodbye, because she had no one else to say goodbye to. Like, we just talked about this. She doesn't have any support group. She doesn't have a family, her maids and whatever. They're just sort of playthings. She doesn't have, an emotional attachment to them. She could think about to say goodbye to was Sherlock, so she said it, and then she was prepared to die, and then it was a complete surprise that he happened to be there.
Not to me.
Well, I'm just saying to her, as a character.
I'd guess that pretty quickly was going to happen.
But also, I know she's not working for Moriarty, and I agree with you completely about what you were saying about how she went to him, but why does she give him the information?
Maybe it was payment, maybe it was for part of a bigger scheme.
Well, we don't know, see, because we've not seen the other two episodes
we don't know.
Yet. So there could be more to it than that.
There could be more to it. Because she got this information by one of her clients. It's important. So maybe she went to Moriarty being like, I have this, so if you help me, this is the information I'll give you.
We don't know what she got in return. She never says what she got in return in payment for this information.
Yeah.
So we don't know what she got out of it. So there could have been, it could be anything that she got out of it.
And I think it may be a larger arc that probably will culminate in Reichenbach.
Well, if you combine the scene at the beginning where Moriarty get the phone call and he said, "Are you sure about this? If you're not sure about this, I will skin you alive," and she's probably talking about that very thing
that
she had. She had this information, and toward the end, this is about when she talks to Mycroft about what she wants and everything. She says, "Moriarty, help her how to play the Holmes brother, which is the ice queen and the virgin." And she because he knows them so well that she knew that by getting information from Moriarty, she would be in that position of power where she would go to Mycroft, because at the end of the day, the target is Mycroft more than anything else. About getting so much from someone so high in the government that, there is absolutely no exit for him and he will have to do it. So that's the way I see it. Hopefully it's part of a bigger arc, because that would be epic.
Yeah, well, cause the thing is, even though that they got the information off of her, they still lost in a way. In fact, probably everybody lost, because we don't know what other information Moriarty got off of her. It's kind of one of those things that I think a lot of people will probably discuss about. There'll be a lot of opinions, probably vastly different, but we still don't know what's going to happen.
So I really want to see her back in the third episode.
Never trust Moffat.
Oh yes, we learned that long ago.
I don't know. I think it would be really almost predictable, but in a good way, that she would be back in Reichenbach, because it's going to be a lot about Sherlock having a hard time, I guess. I'm just guessing. And if she's still, because she's still alive, it doesn't, to me, it doesn't make sense that she wouldn't show up again. She's going to have to at one point. Otherwise, it's such a waste. Damn!
Such a waste of a good character.
I just want her back, I want her back because I think he will either validate or completely destroy any theories we have. And I'm very curious about that, I really want to see that.
Yeah, because, the discussion we had with Artie and, the blogs that I've read that have made me sort of homicidal, they've all had a very extreme feminist point of view. And I'm not, we're all feminists. We believe women need equal rights. But I think
I'm not talking about her as a weak female character.
I know you're not. I'm talking about,
canon.
I know when we were talking about Artie, she had that issue.
Yeah, I think people are, I don't know, I guess maybe more annoyed about them changing the canon, but come on.
It's not a canonical.
That's not the first time they've done it.
It's a nod to the canon, but it's, obviously she's a gay dominatrix. Geoffrey Norton is not a part of this equation.
Yes.
It takes nods to the canon, but you can't, it's not word for word. If you want that, go watch the Granada series. I mean, honestly.
Yeah, or Russian Sherlock Holmes series. Yeah. It's also true to canon.
Because the people saying that she turned into a weak character in the last, 10 minutes, I'm no. She was still very ashamed. Like, she fucked up that one point. Yes, she had...
People fuck up.
Yes, people make mistakes. If they need help, they ask for help. That does not make you a weak person, and I'm getting so angry about this.
Calm down.
Although, if you get me wound up, I'll just, like, snap at someone. If you hear that every person that said anything like that has died, it was probably me. Oops.
That's what again. Turk on you.
That's the thing. Everyone else can control themselves for the sake of politeness, and I'm just like sort of a bit wild and ready to pounce on people.
I don't get worked up about these things, but I am like sincerely angry about people saying that Irene is a weak female just because she gets help. Because like
she's not a weak female at all.
And again, that's what I was saying a bit earlier, but you know, even when Sherlock find the phone, get the code and leave, and she's like, I'm not going to last 6 months or anything, there is still something she wants out of all this, that she completely unsettled Sherlock to the point of him caring enough or being intrigued by her or having to know what she's about to do, what she's doing, to texting, to anything. So she has affected Sherlock's life in a way that for a Sherlock character is massive. Any other character would be like, yeah, well, that's such another person. But for Sherlock, it's like, whoa, it's big. There is the woman. And the way he says it at the end, even after saving her, is the same thing. It's like, you know, he's saying the woman, and then he's saying the woman. Like, he knows that even if he went to rescue her, she's still above him. He's still impressed. He's still like, oh, my God, she was something. So for me, it's a win all the way, no matter what. And that's why I get really angry as well. I'm like, can't you see it? You know, like she actually won on so many levels. Just love it, you know?
And that in itself is a nod to the canon, because he mentions her over and over again in the canon, like a huge amount of time. Like, yeah, it was like four or five.
We did an episode about that, didn't we?
It was like four or five times. So he's always in her mind. Like,
I think I just really want to see somebody finally, I really want to see someone who takes it and updates it or does something new with it, but still just has her get away. That's all I want.
As a poning Sherlock.
She gets away.
She'll be back. She'll pone
she gets
Sherlock.
I'm sure she, that's my hope. But she gets away, but she, I don't know, it just bothers me. I don't like it. I also am not a fan of the part at the end, as much as I love the scene with Mycroft and John in the diner. I think it's brilliant. There's something so wrong to me about the idea that Mycroft would send John Watson upstairs to lie to Sherlock Holmes, thinking that that would be...
He's a bit twisted, isn't he? I think he kind of likes messing around with Sherlock's life, just because he's, I don't know, a sick bastard.
Go out there and lie to him. Like, Sherlock won't know that John, who's, as we said earlier, wears everything on his face.
Yeah. even if, like, we hadn't seen the bit where he told him, like, everybody in England would have known that he was lying.
Yeah.
From the look on Martin Freeman's face, like, we all knew that he was the most terrible liar.
Yeah, I guess I found that, actually, I found that more amusing, I think, than irritating, but I was just like, really?
And also, we found out that Sherlock wanted to be a pirate. I'm sorry,
oh,
but
yeah.
That was epic.
I'm just going
to
be
amazing.
Drawing little pirate Sherlocks now. That's all I'm going to do.
But, you know, I would like to add, though, that is, you know, I said it does bother me, the end, but I loved it. It was so good. I mean, it's one thing to say that something bothers me, but it's just
perfectly fine.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, it's fine that if something in the episode...
I just want to make it very clear, particularly to people who aren't... and I know we don't have a whole lot of people who necessarily listen to us who don't have a pretty good idea of the canon here, that it doesn't detract from the story.
No,
it doesn't. I don't think it does.
And try to make that very clear. Like, this is just a personal gripe more than anything. It doesn't detract from the story, and it doesn't detract from the amazing performances and the brilliant. It really doesn't even detract from the brilliant characterization. I just wasn't happy with it. That's just me. I'm cynical. I'm always cynical.
Yeah. It's fine.
But I loved it. And, you know, three watches, you know. Oh, nobody mentioned that it's always 1895.
Yes, that's
true. It's always 1895.
And the Deerstalker. We forgot about the Deerstalker.
Robin. Batman and Robin.
Yeah.
That was just... Oh, God.
We have a moment to be like, la, 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 la. Yeah, that was beautiful.
I just love that, like, and the entire thing is always these nods, and not necessarily to the canon, but to sort of, like, the fandom and sort of, like, the world.
Everything.
That, like, surrounded Sherlock Holmes. Like, obviously, the Deerstalker is not canon. That was Sidney Paget's, like, fetish.
Oh, Sidney Paget. We've done a whole episode about you.
The Deerstalker. Fetish.
Oh, by the way, if you go on to the yes. website, John's blog has been updated, and one of the detectives is called Sidney Paget, which is just beautiful. Definitely go and read them.
Everything about that blog is
updated.
Is absolutely beautiful. Make sure you read all the comments as well as the stories.
Yes, yeah. And the Twitter account exists as well.
Yes, the whip hand. There's two of them. There's the whip hand, like all one word, that I think may be run by the BBC.
Yeah.
And then there's a fan one, the_whip_hand.
Yeah.
But the BBC one, I think, has been up for a while.
Yeah.
Because no one obviously knew what it was.
Yeah, so nobody added it.
But it's there. It's got like 4,000 some odd followers or something.
And it's only following like Moffat and Gatiss.
Yeah.
And also, I feel like mentioning something else, even if we mention it in passing. I just want to say, like how amazing the music is. So David Arnold and Michael Price, thank you so very much. It was stunning. This is we're talking movie material here. This is like Gatiss was talking about in the Q&A, that we are crossing the line. It's so this is 1.5 hours of television that goes so much into cinematic and movie-wise. It's just beautiful, and the music was stunning on the same level, so thank you, guys.
Well, I think what it does is it challenges, you know, what we think of as being worthy of television quality, and I hope that what this does is it makes people up their game. Obviously,
yeah.
We've got Game of Thrones, for anybody who watches that, which has really upped the game in terms of what kind of things they can use in TV series, and Sherlock shows that, you know, even without like a large amount of computer graphics, you can still do something that is different and phenomenal. Just with the direction, the acting, the music, you know, it's fantastic.
However, I would really, really, really like Benedict to be able to bow a violin properly.
Even to somebody who doesn't play the violin, I'm sorry. That was really noticeable.
Really not good.
I guess only in his defense, his violin coach did post a blog about teaching him, and he only had a week.
Aww.
So I mean, he only had a week to do everything, and that's including Belgravia and Reichenbach. So
I really, really, really think that what the problem is there is that, because his technique, like the positions that he holds everything in, are perfect.
Yeah, they're great.
It's the rhythm.
Yeah,
and I don't know
they
if
they synced it. It didn't
sync
well.
I don't know, but it just it drives me nuts.
Yeah, don't tend to play the music until afterwards.
Yeah,
apparently she was playing it, and like he was watching her through like the window.
Oh, really?
Which I thought was kind of cool, but it's like some parts it's okay, and other parts I'm like, no, you have to keep moving. You can't just keep singing.
Yeah.
My favorite is you can't change the bow while a note's happening. I love him, but you know.
I'm glad to see violin playing.
Yeah,
I'm so happy about that.
I was really hoping that it would be that thing that where just Sherlock just thinks that he can play the violin and actually is really terrible. That would have been absolutely hilarious.
But no, he actually can play a little bit, which is good.
Yeah. He composes.
He composes. Yeah.
Helps him think. Oh.
And then there's a new dressing gown.
Yes.
Red one.
Spruced up his wardrobe. Probably with
second
slightly
favorite.
bigger shirts now that he's put on a bit of bulk.
But not so much.
Exactly.
I don't think they changed his shirt, considering. if you look at the episode, you just go like, did you actually change the shirt?
It's like, just put a size up. It really, costume department.
They do it on purpose.
Yes.
They do. All the fangirls.
It works.
not we are complaining. No. Poor buttons, though.
I still have a soft spot for the
the Christmas jumper. I'm sorry. I can't get over it.
And poor John's girlfriends.
Oh, oh yeah.
Oh. John pre-continent.
Yes. Awesome. Let's have a moment to, like, mourn all the poor girls of Britain who've had to put up with John.
I mean, I just love, I mean, just like a small moment when he actually gets out and think he's going to meet Mycroft, the whole exchange with Irene's assistant and him,
yes,
is just, I was dying because it was like, Martin Freeman, what are you doing right now?
I love that he just immediately, like, just hits on her and never questions why she's standing outside of his door, like, hello, yes. John.
It's like every criminal in the London, like, underworld knows how to get John Watson. He's a weak man.
That is the best thing ever, though. It's like, just send a woman at the door. That's going to work.
Yeah. Maybe that's how he was kidnapped by Moriarty.
But that's on the blog now. It says
how he did
was
it.
In a cab, I think, and they forced him in. They chloroformed him.
Oh, well.
Obviously, would have just been easier to send a woman after him.
I know.
Yeah, I know.
Come with me, John. Okay.
And let's not forget about that lovely comments from Benedict Cumberbatch at the Q&A, who called Martin Freeman Martin Freehands. because apparently when Lara Pulver was filming the scene, the naked scene.
The straining eyes scene.
Yes, exactly. The hand she had to worry about were not Benedict's hands. I'm only repeating, so I've seen it live, they said it out loud, I'm not inventing anything. So, yes.
Benedict calls Martin Freehands, and he calls him Cumberlord.
And everything is beautiful and nothing hurts.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, the some of the things that my family call Benedict Cumberbatch should not be repeated on the air.
What did your sister say? That cucumber man?
Yes, yeah, so she was reading the Times article. She was like, oh, this is it's that cucumber man that you like in here. And I was like, I actually knew who she was talking about, which is quite terrible. I can't remember what my dad said. There was something really funny. It was some really terrible pronunciation of his name.
No, I think there are many. Cumberbunny.
Well, I had fun. Like the scene with Moriarty laughing. That was it.
Yes.
And he's just standing there looking absolutely stunning. How in a year of walking around London looking like that has he not turned a few heads? And hidden from the police, you know?
Brilliant. It's just the way he got really coolly strolls around with, like, aviators on.
Yeah, so
like,
it's the aviators. Like, you put on glasses, you're instantly unrecognizable.
Yeah, it's like Superman. No one ever suspected.
You know what? Okay, I will say, that works a lot better than you'd think.
It does.
When we were here locally, we were at Dragon Con. We were responsible for taking Sylvester McCoy around, and at one point he literally put a fake mustache on made of duct tape.
Oh god,
and
genius.
No one talked to him.
It's probably because he was a man with duct tape stuck to his face.
No, but the thing is, he literally took it off, and within a minute there was a line of like 10 people wanting photographs. It's literally it was like seeing something that happens only on cartoons in action. I understand now.
Well, you know when you see really famous people who wears caps and hats, and you think, well, that's a cheap trick. Well, it actually works really well because I've seen it so many times, and people don't pay attention because they can't really look at the face properly, and then they just give up on recognizing, like they don't really see it.
I've said it before, and I'll say it again: all white people look the same.
Yes.
You spend way too much time in China.
No, honestly, white people all look the same.
That's true.
On that note,
let's wrap up the show!
So should we go around and give, like, how many stars? Like, I don't know.
That's really cheesy,
Curly. It is really cheesy.
Go back to America. What are you doing here?
Go back to China.
Bitch.
What are you doing?
I love this episode. I thought it was perfect. I'm so happy, and I'm so excited for Hounds of Baskerville next week.
Oh, yes. Oh, can I add one more thing that wasn't mentioned?
No!
Here we go, please.
Ignore her. Carry on.
But we didn't talk about the wallpaper any.
Oh, yes! Wallpaper appreciation squeeze!
Okay, now you can end the episode.
Again, thanks to Paul McGuigan.
The Cluedo board game stuck on the wall with the knife as well.
That was cool. The wall with like a knife.
Brilliant.
This is all thanks to Tumblr, who has like capped every scene in this episode.
And is telling us what's in the background and every 2 inches of... Yeah.
Because no one can obsess like fangirls can.
It takes 10 minutes for the internet to just capture GIF and make assumption about everything, which is absolutely crazy. So it's brilliant. Thank you, internet. That helps a lot.
Okay. All
right, guys.
This has been eventful, full of passion
and rage,
intrigue, and bums. Yes. Very shapely bums.
Yes, we do. We enjoy it. All the bums. And on that note, bum 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 bum. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you too?